You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast by the young, hip, and lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Zach Davis.
Thank God you're back. I'm glad you got some rest on vacation, but man, I was trying to host the show by myself for the past couple weeks, and I think we've lost at least half our audience. So
all right,
hopefully
come back, audience. I'm here.
How was your time?
It was amazing.
And so remind people where you were.
Yes, I spent 2 weeks in Amman, Jordan. I have a friend who works and lives in Amman, so I was staying with her and then doing some side trips throughout the country. I went to Wadi Rum, which is where it's of Star Wars fame. It's where the famous race scene is filmed.
Oh, some pod racing.
Yeah, nice. I think The Martian was filmed there. So it's like it's that red
desert
sand with the crazy rock structures. So we spent night in camp there. We went to Petra. That's of Indiana Jones fame.
Also history fame.
Yeah, also history.
Not just movies.
Floated in the Dead Sea. So it was an amazing trip.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
We've got a busy week. We're prepping for, you know, getting up towards the end of the season. Got about a month left. So it's going to be a busy next 5 or 6 weeks or so. So get ready.
Yeah. And get ready for a great episodes because it's all Catholic Sisters all the time.
Yeah. I don't think it's Catholic Sisters week, but it might as well be on this podcast. So who are we chatting with?
We are talking to Sister Donna Dodge. She is the president of the Sisters of Charity of New York, who announced earlier this month that they are going to embark on a path of completion, which means they're basically not going to be accepting new vocations. They're going to continue their ministries, but that they're kind of wrapping up their current state as a congregation.
Yeah, and we were covering this a couple weeks ago on Signs of the Time, so it was really exciting to have an opportunity to talk to Sister Donna about, you know, what went into that decision making, how the sisters are feeling, and how they're still kind of gearing up for, you know, they've got a good 30 years left in them. So stay tuned.
Yeah. And Sister Donna suggested that we have scotch. So we are drinking scotch on the rocks today.
In her honor. And
cheers.
To the Sisters of Charity.
So stick around for our conversation with Sister Donna Dodge. But first, we have Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. And our first story this week comes from California. On May 4th, the Los Angeles Dodgers sparked an ongoing controversy when they announced that the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, a group of drag queens who dress in women's religious habits, not actual sisters, would be included in the Dodgers Pride Night later in June. And to break down this complicated and ongoing story is our friend and colleague, Mike O'Loughlin, the national correspondent for America Media. Welcome back to Jesuitical, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's good to see you. I'm wondering if you could just like take us back to this original announcement for the Dodgers. Like, what's the context of this night that the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are being included in?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think for the vast majority of people who now know about the story, we learned about it through a group called Catholic Vote, which highlighted the announcement because they were not happy that the Dodgers were honoring this group, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. As Ashley said, it's a group of drag queens, activists who trace their roots back to the early days of the HIV and AIDS crisis in California. They raise money for charitable organizations. They provide services to people with HIV and AIDS. I think in more recent years, they sort of expanded into more general visibility around the LGBT community. And they dress as nuns. They're guys dressing as nuns, so they kind of want to raise attention through that.
And not just simple nuns. Can you describe what this looks like?
Yes, like way over the top. Like if you were to imagine drag queen nuns, that's what you would get. There's a little bit of black and white clothing involved as sort of an homage to mm-hmm. traditional habits of Catholic sisters. But I'm not sure that anymore, even if people were to look at them, they would understand that they were supposed to be nuns. It's kind of way over the top. But still, some people take offense at it. It is sort of a snarky way, either mocking, ridiculing, or drawing inspiration from Catholic sisters, depending on your point of view. And Catholic Vote and the Catholic League were upset about this, put pressure on the Dodgers to cancel. Senator Marco Rubio sent a letter to the commissioner of Major League Baseball. Big social media storm, and the Dodgers did cancel. We kind of thought that was the end of the story initially, but the backlash to the backlash happened. A lot of LGBT activists weighed in, said that the Dodgers weren't standing by the community. And ultimately, the Dodgers backtracked and said, yes, we are going to invite them to Pride Night. So on June 16th, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence will be honored at Dodgers baseball game and given an award for their community service. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, this group that some people think ridicule Catholic nuns will be given a big platform at this baseball game.
What were some of the specific criticisms, either from Catholic Vote or Senator Marco Rubio?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like, they are drawing inspiration or mocking Catholic sisters. So there is an element of, I don't know if it goes up to anti-Catholicism. The group itself says they're not anti-Catholic. They say what they're trying to do is hold a mirror up to how some people use religion to legitimize homophobia. But it is, I think, hard to take. I wrote an essay for America this week saying that when I saw these individuals sort of making fun or poking fun at Catholic sisters, I kind of thought about the Catholic sisters who have done really heroic work, who really don't get the credit they deserve, who don't really wield much power in the church. And it kind of made me a bit uncomfortable that they were kind of punching down, is what I think I wrote, that it didn't seem like they were going after the right targets if they were angry at religion. But I was able to find a Catholic sister, a real Catholic sister, who said that she didn't feel that same kind of offense that some groups like Catholic Vote or the Catholic League or Marco Rubio felt. So I think it's a pretty complicated subject. Do you look at it as someone mocking the church, or do you see the good work they do and say they're just kind of being ridiculous to raise awareness about their cause?
Well, one thing that I think understandably rankles is something we've talked about on the show before, is that people feel pretty comfortable mocking the Catholic Church, whether that's like Pope Francis and the AI-generated art of in the puffer coat, in ways that they might not mock other religions. I think in your piece, you mentioned that way back in 2011, Andrew Sullivan made the point that that the group would never dare dress up as the Prophet Muhammad during Ramadan, and yet they had this drag queen show about hunky Jesus on Easter. So do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think there's something to it. I would say that there's been some pushback against that kind of thinking, because to be a Muslim in the United States in certain parts of the country is probably more challenging than to be a Christian, to be a Catholic. So it's probably not exactly the same. But in terms of ridiculing who has power and who doesn't, I think that's a part of drag that some people don't pick up on. And it's used to kind of poke fun at people who have power and who use that power to hurt other people. I just don't know that Catholic sisters wield all that much power. Maybe at one point in time they did. Maybe some people have had bad experiences with Catholic sisters. But I think generally, when you look at the church, it's a little bit in the weeds, but Catholic sisters aren't the ones with the power. So if you want to ridicule the church because of its stance on homosexuality and how it uses its influence to maybe generate certain laws, to support certain laws that go against LGBT rights, I don't know if sisters, I don't know if they're the ones who are pushing that agenda. It might be Catholic bishops, it might be lay people. So for me, it was just this power dynamic that I didn't think made sense.
And you did talk to a Catholic sister about this story based in Los Angeles. What was her take on it?
Yeah, Sister Joanne DeQuatro. She's a sister of the Holy Names. She's 84, longtime activist, started protesting in the 1980s against U.S. military involvement in Central America, moved on to anti-death penalty work, social justice work. And I was surprised a little bit to hear what she had to say, because I thought there was some possibility that she might be offended, that Catholic sisters might be offended by how this other group portrays them. But she said, no, look, she understands that activists do whatever they can to raise attention, and that they dress in over-the-top ways and kind of tell risque jokes. And if it gets attention for their cause, which she said was a good cause, she said basically they're living out the corporal works of mercy, then she understood and she wasn't offended. She said she was more offended by members of Congress who are cutting the budget for social safety net programs. She said that's more offensive to her than these kind of costume guys who she's known about for years, because she said in California, you can't really escape them. So I was surprised, but in some ways I'm not, because I think these sisters
are classically humble, right? Like humble, yeah, and not, you know, easily offended.
It takes a lot because they're kind of in the trenches doing the hard work. So I don't think they're as easily offended as some other folks. So I thought it was a unique perspective. So I'm glad we got a chance to report on it over at America.
Do you think the Dodgers are going to reverse course again in the face of renewed outrage among the Catholics?
I will be very surprised if they reverse course, but I would not be surprised to see something later in the season that honors some kind of Catholic social justice group. I think that's probably the best bet from a crisis communication standpoint.
Well, those odds are on FanDuel Live right now. No, I'm kidding, in terms of best bets. Well, Mike, we will link to your report in our show notes, and people can read that, as always, and along with the rest of your work at americamagazine.org. Thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And now stick around for our conversation with Sister Donna Dodge. Joining us in studio is Sister Donna Dodge. Sister Donna is the president of the Sisters of Charity of New York. Welcome to Jesuitical, Sister Donna.
Thank you very much, Ashley.
We're so glad to have you. And maybe just like to set the stage, could you tell us, when did you enter the Sisters of Charity in New York?
I entered in 1966, which is right after, during Vatican II.
Yeah, like right, pretty exciting time.
Yeah, and it was exciting because I was on the cusp of the changes. When I entered, I was the last group to wear the cap, the widow, you know, the habit of the Sisters of Charity. They had a like a black widow's cap, which was what Mother Seton wore at that time.
Okay.
And so I had that for maybe two or three years, then went to a veil, and then right after that, we went into lay clothes. So I had some of the old things, and I was able to at least appreciate what the sisters went through when they talked about the olden days. But then I was freer to make my choices about ministries and things like that.
Can you talk about your decision to join? What was going through your head? And did those old things attract you? Or were you like, okay, the Vatican II happened, we'll be getting rid of those soon. So I have
a crazy path. And when everybody asks to tell about your vocation story, I had gone to Cardinal Spellman High School in the Bronx. I could say I was a pupil there, not a student, really, because I had a lot of fun. And five of my good friends decided to enter.
That is something you do not hear today.
No, that's right, you don't.
Yeah, like a group of friends.
Peer pressure to join them.
Well, they said to me, I didn't know what I was going to do or what I wanted to do in life. And they said, come on, why don't you come with us? We'll have a good time. And there was some prayer in it, but not, I have to say at that time, not too much. And so I did, just trying to be open to a new experience. And they all left, and I stayed. In fact, some sister had a bet that I'd be the first one to leave, but
I hope they
I wasn't.
Paid up.
So that's a strange path.
I mean, once you were in, what was it about it that made you stay as opposed to those who left?
I think it was the call to community, the exposure to Vatican II ideas in the church, and the wanting desperately to serve in some way. And that seemed to be a good path.
And what was it like to, I mean, you know, you enter with all these friends, but and have they leave at some point. Mm-hmm. But the years after Vatican II, from my understanding, was a period where a lot of people left religious life. Yeah. What was it like to kind of weather that or stick through it?
I don't think I was that conscious of it at that time because they weren't my friends the people I entered with were leaving. But it wasn't like I was with people for 15, 20 years and then they decided to leave. So I didn't find it as painful as some of the other sisters whose peers had left.
But it was a painful time.
It was also an exciting time. Our congregation was good because they brought us all over the place to different kind of lectures and marches in Washington and the Poor People's March and Fordham University and, you know, for lectures on what was happening in the church. And so we were exposed to all of that. So it was also an exciting time. Mm-hmm. I have to say that.
Yeah. Can you, for those who aren't in New York and so they don't see all the great works that the Sisters of Charity do here, can you describe kind of like, you know, what your ministry was at, you know, the peak when you had over 1,000 sisters here?
We were almost responsible practically for every school in Manhattan and the Bronx, which we then passed on to other communities. Staten Island, we were in Brooklyn. We were at our peak, we were probably about 1,300-1,400 sisters.
In the New York area?
In New York area. And then we had hospitals, we had orphanages.
And how do these ministries sort of live on today with lower numbers? What are the Sisters of Charity?
Right now? We call it the ministries with which we are in a relationship. Because sponsored has a number of different ways, meanings. It's not like we pay for them to continue. But three of our biggest ones are Elizabeth Seton Children's in Yonkers. That's one of the largest, almost nursing homes for young people. And I forget what percentage are on ventilators. It might be like 60% of them or something like that. But it's just an amazing work that the people there do. We have St. Joseph's Medical Center in Yonkers. And we have New York Foundling.
One of our good friends moved to New York to work at the New York Foundling. So I have a personal thank you for that, bringing our friend Hannah to us.
Oh, good. It's a great ministry. Those are the three biggest we have. We have a housing ministry that is probably only began in the 80s, but we have over, I might be wrong about this, 800, 900 units of housing in affordable housing in Rockland County, Staten Island, Hamilton Heights, and East Harlem.
Now, it's impressive that these are
still— And I'm not
still,
even finished,
no,
Zach.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. But we also have a street ministry called LEFSA, Life Experience and Faith Sharing. And we have hired formerly homeless people, and they go into the shelters and they work with homeless people and they give them information about resources. They bring them food on the streets and they give them a sense of faith and they pray with them. And that went on right through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it's homeless, formerly homeless people. So it's not like somebody just coming in and say, poor you. Yeah. You know, they know what the people have been going through. We have a small women's ministry. Works with right now with students, high school students. We have an organic farm in Stamfordville, New York, about 90 miles away. I'm going to forget something, and then they're going to kill me.
I mean, needless to say, it sounds like, I mean, you guys have been and are still currently like mm-hmm. running ministries that touch, you know, millions of people in the New York area. It's a testament that even as you've had declining numbers of sisters.
And how many sisters are there today?
Unless somebody died when on my way down here, we have 153.
153 from, you know, a peak of, you know, 1,300, 1,400. A lot of the, in other contexts, maybe in a business world or something, these institutions would have just shut down. And yet you guys have managed to enter into different ways of relationship with these different ministries and so that they can continue on and continue to serve the people of the city.
Right. Well, we passed the torch on to our lay colleagues, and they do a fantastic job. They have a sense of charism, a sense of spirit of the Sisters of Charity that we didn't give them. They came with it, and we connected, and they're carrying on these ministries. They're just wonderful men and women who are doing this.
Could you quickly summarize that charism that the sisters animates
the
Sisters of Charity?
It's the charism of charity, of respect, of trying to treat everybody with the dignity that they need, that they deserve, and a sense of justice. And other people have that, but it's something that we share with the people who work with us, so it's really great.
Hi there, it's Ashley.
And Zach.
If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with theologians, ministers, and pastors, then I recommend adding the acclaimed show No Small Endeavor to your podcast queue.
Each episode, host and award-winning theologian Lee C. Camp brings you thoughtful conversations with special guests, like the Queen of Christian Pop, Amy Grant, and pastor and theologian Tish Harrison Warren, about what it means to find true happiness and flourish in our everyday life.
As The Guardian said, No Small Endeavor is a must-listen, and I couldn't agree more. So don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now, and tell them we sent you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So
So I want to go to the big decision that your congregation made earlier this month to go on what you call a path to completion. Can you take us back to the time before that where you were discerning the future of your congregation and what you were thinking together as a community?
It's not a clear process that we went through. One of the things that we've done for the last 4 years when I've been president is sharing with our congregation the demographics. So all of our sisters know that we haven't taken anybody in years.
How long?
It's about 21 years was the last person that we had enter. And that person was even older than I am now. So that's been a reality. We didn't stop and mourn it at that point, but
when did that first enter maybe into your head that okay, maybe the demographics are shifting a certain way, we've got to make some big decisions?
We've known
soon.
It all along, and if nobody new was coming to you, then
right,
and you can't keep everybody alive, you are on a path to completion. You know, now we do have associates who are lay men and women who work with us, but it's not the same kind of thing. So we every 4 years we come together and we plan for the future and we set goals, like many other congregations do that. You know, what do you want to accomplish in the next 4 years? And when we looked at that, we said, you know what, we need to call the question. We need to name the reality. We're always good at reading the signs of the times. All of the ministries we have respond to needs of the times, and they change. So as we looked at planning for the next 4 years, we said, you know, we need to say we're coming to completion. And we're doing it with faith, knowing that God, who has been with us all along, every step of the way, will continue to be with us and show us what we need to do for the coming years.
Was that a unanimous feeling?
It was a I can't believe that. I really can't believe it, Ashley. When we voted, we did this with holding up green cards for yes and red for no and orange, I guess, or something for abstentions. I figured people would abstain because even though they knew it was the reality, they didn't want to vote for it. And so our council, which is our leadership team, put out a proposal that we would recognize that we are on the path to completion and we will do all we can to promote vocations throughout the United States, but just not with us. And unanimous. So.
What was that like, either emotionally or spiritually? Because I imagine there had to be at some point a level of grief that comes with this.
It was. When we said that, you could see the faces in the room, and a lot of people started to tear up. I was at the podium, and I couldn't walk off the podium. My leg was shaking. Because to know something in your head is one thing, and then to feel it as a reality in your heart, it was very moving. I have to say it was a moving experience. And then somebody suggested that we bring up a book that had the names of all of the sisters who have gone before us, so all of the people who had ever entered. And so they brought it up to the stage. And then our facilitator had us chant Ubi Caritas, where charity and love is, there is God. And so there was just this chant in the room. It was on Instagram. I can't even look at it anymore because it's very, very moving. And then we had a prayer service. And I think people felt a peace. And so, you know, the peace gave us a freedom. You know, we put the reality on the table. Now let's do what we have to continue to serve those on the margins, which is what we're about.
And where does that freedom come from? Because I don't think a lot of people think of, you know, the death of an individual or an organization as a freeing experience. It feels like a loss.
Well, we're not going away right away. And that's one of the things some of the articles were saying. We closed our doors. We didn't close our doors. We're even trying to start new ministries if we can. So we're not going away any time very, very soon. So we could just focus on what we need to do, and that's service.
And how old is your youngest sister right now?
Maybe six. Well, we have some sisters in Guatemala. This was just about the United States right now. So, but in the United States, about 69.
So, I mean, and most nons that I've known have lived pretty long lives. So,
well,
I mean,
they
could
long
easily
time.
You
yeah.
guys could easily be around for another 30 years.
Yeah, we're
right?
not going away, right?
But is there a sense around, like, okay, someone is going to be the last right. one, and who's and how are we going to, you know, hand on some of the, but like even the book, for example, that you mentioned, like some of these things that have been with us for a long time, in addition to the ministries, like.
Well, we have to look at our archives. Where is the best place that, that we should put that history? We're looking at ways to continue the legacy beyond us, whether it's an institute, I don't want to say, well, for justice and peace or something like that, that could live on in perpetuity. And continue to pass on the charism to those who come, you know, behind us. So we're looking at that, and we're going to work with each of our ministries and say, what do you need from us in order to continue the spirit of charity and continue what you're doing?
Your charism being charity, there's nothing unique. You don't have to be a vowed religious or a priest or ordained to have that charism.
Right.
So there, it seems like you do have some sort of advantage in passing this
right.
on.
I had been holding back on charity because I thought I had to be vowed or ordained to practice it.
So that's why you haven't, Zach. Okay, we knew there was something.
But so how, do you have ways of promoting and instilling that in your lay collaborators, you know, that can live on beyond?
We have a couple of programs, and one of them is Keepers of the Flame. And it's a program that one of our sisters, Sister Karen Helfenstein, started. And we have a facilitator and a couple of sisters that help. And we invite board members to participate in a year-long program. And they learn about our founders. They learn about our ministries. They learn about prayer. I mean, they share what they know about prayer. We don't teach them how to pray. They come, they're just phenomenal in terms of what they share with us. And we pass the history on. And hopefully then they take it to somebody else. And we want to continue that program. It's a very, very good Keepers of the Flame.
When Ashley and I were covering this story on this podcast when it first happened, I had mentioned that it occurred to me that if a religious order exists, you know, for a couple hundred years, mm-hmm. that is no small feat.
No,
in, right, yeah. you know, in the life of the church or right. the life of the country. And so I had hoped that, you know, the you all and all your supporters and the entire church were able to look at this not as a failure, but, you know, as a
no.
beautiful gift that mm-hmm. you've been able to give the church and New York City. Do you feel like that's the sense among yourself?
I
and
do.
Your sisters?
I think the sisters feel that. We're very grateful for what people before us have done and what we have done. And I had said this in one of the articles when somebody asked what was the highlight, one of the highlights of the last couple of years. And I said it was when we were honored in the St. Patrick's Day parade, and we had this big banner, Sisters of Charity, and people were carrying it, and people came out into the street and said, thank you for educating me. Thank you for taking care of so-and-so in the hospital. Thank you for everything. And it wasn't us who were marching who they were thanking. It was our predecessors. And we had some really great women who have done great things in the church.
How is coming to the decision to no longer seek vocations changed how you think about vocations in the church? Because I think colloquially people think of it as entering religious life. But does the church need to change the way it talks about vocations for young people?
Certainly. And I think the church has tried to do that. There are very valid vocations that are equal. One is not better than the other, which is a different way. And I do think there's a place for religious vocations. It's just not going to be the same. We don't know how it's going to transpire. And we belong to a federation of 14 other who take their spirit from Vincent de Paul and or Elizabeth Seton. And this is a charity federation. And some of those sisters are getting vocations. And we're going to support that in whatever way we can.
What are some reasons that a young person today should consider if they were thinking about joining the Sisters of Charity? Or what would your pitch be? Maybe not to the Sisters of Charity in New York, but to the larger federation.
I guess if they wanted to concentrate, it's a big decision. It's a big decision not to have a family or to spend your life with somebody whom you love, you know, dearly. But if somebody felt a call to community and a call to more, I shouldn't say even more prayer, because everybody should pray or have some kind of relationship with God. So I think it's probably the community and willing to take, a vows and to live hopefully simpler life than other people, and commitment to justice and peace. Those are some of the things I tell them to explore.
It's interesting because I think that a lot of those things, with the exception of maybe a vows, I think young people are largely attracted to. Or there's a renaissance in a lot of these movements today. So this my own personal feeling is that I feel like a lot of people would benefit from at least asking the question, if this is for me, And I don't know if you've had any experiences where you've seen some people even just, you know, ask the question and that opens them up into their vocation, maybe out of religious life.
Right. And that's a gift to the church too. So that hasn't happened. I haven't seen that in a long time, but it's possible, you know, and having worked with young people in higher education, I just see the goodness and they're just tremendous. They're tremendous people out there. And you just hope that they could find whatever God is calling them to. And it is a call. It is a call.
You served in a lot of roles in your time in the Sisters of Charity. I'm curious what has been the most grace-filled part of...
I loved them all. Everything I did, I loved. I've had some really good experience. I've been very blessed.
I mean, maybe that's another advertisement. You know, I mean, not everybody gets to, you know, work in so many different parts.
That's true.
That is, I mean, I think a gift of religious life to be, you know, to be free, to be kind of dispatched to all these different people and communities.
Right. And if you're not, if you don't have to support a family, so that's a whole other thing. You don't have to worry about feeding kids.
Your own kids anyway.
Your own kids, yeah.
Right, I think you were worried about feeding several thousand kids.
Right. But you don't have to worry about that. So that's freeing and you can concentrate on trying to do good for others.
What are you going to be concentrating on in the coming years?
Well, I want to get our ministries in shape so that they can go into the future with confidence and with hope, as we have. And then there are some administrative things that we have to look at. That's not the most pleasant thing. And then I hope we can continue to respond to different needs. Like right now, we're trying to see what's the best way we can help the migrant situation. So we're open to trying to do that. So we're not going to give that kind of a thing up. Our older sisters are advocates. They write letters. They make calls. So they'll continue to.
You know, most older religious sisters I know are not very good at retiring and relaxing. Right. Is that planned in the future at all? Where, you know, you get a chance to take a breath and just kind of look at the legacy of the Sisters of Charity in New York, or even in your own vocation, all the lives that you've been able to touch?
Well, hopefully our prayer deepens as we get older and do less. I hope that happens to me.
Getting a chance to kind of look back. Sister Donna, I wanted to thank you on behalf of a member of this city and of this church for all that you have done, for all the Sisters of Charity New York have done. You've been a gift to all of us. So thank you and your sisters for everything
that
you've done.
For saying that.
We do have one final question for you, though, that we ask all of our guests, which is if you could canonize one person, living or dead, Catholic or not, fictional or real, who would it be and why?
I think we have a lot of people walking around who are saints, and I couldn't pick out one over another. I've never had... I don't know. I've never been like a hero worshiper, or I just try to look for the good in each person. So maybe the two of you. I would canonize the two of you.
Thank you.
For being reflective. We've been doing this for 6 years.
For being reflective and for caring about this topic. And hopefully Sebastian will reward you.
With canonization?
With something.
All right. Sister, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we are going to... We know that the Sister Charity New York are not going to be...
Not going away
anytime soon. So we will be paying attention and supporting and cheering from this desk.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you.
Bye. I thought it would kill me. I thought it would kill me to fall again. But I hit the ground running. So I didn't feel a single thing. My mind was occupied.
All right, now it's time for parish announcements, the part of our show where we ask you to please be seated before the final blessing. Just a couple things this week. So one, we'd like to kind of go on a push. We're going to say this a few times before this season ends, but we would love if we could do a push to get some ratings on Apple Podcasts. We love reading all the nice comments that come in. That's great. But more importantly, it really does help other people find the show. So if you've already hit up all of your semi-quasi-Catholic or fully Catholic friends in your life and you want to help more people discover Jesuitical, an easy way to do that is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So you don't have to write one, but that is also welcome. So please, if you have just like 5 minutes while you're listening right now, just pull up your phone and do it, unless you're driving, in which case get safely to your destination. Secondly, I would love to thank a new Patreon supporter this week. So a huge shout out to Beth Lenihan, who signed up this week to support the show on Patreon. She's going to get access to our full backlog of bonus episodes and all the ones that are to come. So if you would like to join Beth, you can do that at patreon.com/americamedia.
And now we have As One Friend Speaks to Another, the part of our show where we talk about where we're finding God in our lives this week. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, I was in Jordan and went to Petra. This is ancient buildings carved into the rock structures that are just intricate and amazing and done in like 1,000 years ago and incredible. But, you know, they're deep in the desert, so you have to get there. And there's an easy way to get there that the tourists do. Go to the visitor center, walk in, walk out.
But you're not a tourist.
I was with a local.
Yeah.
So we did what the locals do. And that is you get dropped off by a taxi on the side of the road in the middle of the desert and walk your way there.
And you chose.
And we chose.
Poorly.
Poorly. Me and my friend got dropped off on the side of the road. We had 2 bottles of water, and we were going to make our way to...
For a walk in the desert? Bad start.
To what's known as the monastery, one of these beautiful structures that's in the desert. And so starting going well, we're on a big main road, or, you know, not a main road, but a road that is clearly marked. And then it gets less clear, and we take the wrong path. And we take the wrong path for about 1.5 hours. And we are in what's known as... like a wadi, so you have these big rock structures, not quite mountains, but and you're just walking in the valley. And everything looks the same. There are the same trees, the same red rocks. And so we've been doing this for 1.5 hours, and my friend says, we should have reached it by now. We should have reached it 1 hour ago.
Good.
And so we realize we are lost. And her phone is about to die. My phone has about 40% battery and has no service. So the maps really aren't doing any... good. We try to text friends to let them know that we are lost in the desert because we're starting to panic. And so we turn around, try to retrace our steps. Retracing our steps, realize we have not retraced our steps. We have traced new steps. And it is at that point when I realize there's not an easy just walk back out to the road solution that the panic really sets in. And I am scared. We don't have a lot of water. We have no way of reaching civilization. And I'm imagining myself wandering and perhaps perishing in the desert. So that would have been
bad for you and the podcast.
Yes. And it was honestly a new experience for me. I have not had a lot of times in my life where I'm not in control, scared, and not really sure what's going to come next, and thinking that what does come next is not going to be good at all. So we kind of regroup ourselves, retrace our steps again, get what we think is on the right path, and just walk. And then eventually, in the distance, we see a Bedouin shepherd, a literal shepherd. That you hear about in the Bible. And, you know, we wave at him. We walk over. We're not sure he's going to speak English because not all Bedouin shepherds do speak English. We go over. He speaks perfect English. And we are like, thank God. And they give us tea. And we ask him where we're supposed to be going. And he says he will walk us to the monastery.
So you're saying he left the 99 in order to... search for and guide the lost.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
All right. Okay. Still following.
And so our dear shepherd guide, his name is Ali, walks over 1 hour with me and my friend to get us safely to the monastery. He does not leave us until we are with a bunch of tourists and have no chance of getting lost on our way out. It is the closest I've got to really experiencing and understanding the image of Jesus, the good shepherd.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and but the feeling that sticks with me most is that moment of panic and fear and loss of control. And so it was just like such, it was so visceral that it connected me to that image of needing a guide in a way that I've never had before. And it made me think about, like, a lot of the Gospels are written in a way that made a lot of sense to the people at the time. They use the images of the earth and of farming and of
wilderness
and wilderness. That was wilderness. I understand the temptations.
Well, and it's quite literally the same wilderness that is often being written about in the Bible.
Yeah. So it made me think about, you know, how us moderns can have difficulty accessing the gospel because we don't have those visceral experiences. And I'm not saying everyone should go get lost in the desert of Jordan, but I'm wondering, like, are there other ways that we can try to connect to the gospel in more visceral ways that don't involve risking our lives?
Yeah, as you said, we moderns like to pretend we have lots of control over everything in our lives. In a lot of ways, we do. We have way more control. We have air conditioning, for crying out loud, right? Like, that is, you know, for most of human, we have lights, you know, for most of human history, these things didn't exist.
Unlimited seltzer water in our refrigerator.
Yes, exactly. These things. And so I think there is like a great spiritual lesson. I didn't even experience this. Hearing you talk about it made me think about, like, oh my God, what does it mean to feel totally lost and totally helpless in a way that's not just a metaphor?
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank God for Saint Ali. I think he's worthy of canonization on this podcast.
I will be, Saint Ali. He is my guide. Every time I'm lost, I will be praying to him.
I was ready for that, like, story to end with, and we turned around and he disappeared. And he was gone, and it was an angel.
And the footsteps next to us were Jesus all along.
Yeah.
No, it was flesh and blood, real shepherd, who I will be eternally grateful for. So for listeners, I don't know if I have any practical advice for you, besides that, you know, don't take the back entrance to Petra. Go to the visitor center, walk in, walk out. It's beautiful.
It was not worth it. All right. Awesome. Well, I'm glad you're back and safe.
I will get us out of here. Jesuitical is produced by Sebastian Gomes with production assistance from Kevin Jackson and Christopher Spielman. Our sound engineer is Kevin Christopher Robles. Faith formation provided by Father Eric Sundrup. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/Jesuitical. Please subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you're on Apple or Spotify, leave us a review. Jesuitical is recorded in the William J. Loschert Studio at America Media in New York City. For America Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Zach Davis. We'll see you next week.